Today is December 12, 2011, and it's Sefer HaChinuch, and we're going to be doing mitzvot 216 through 223, Be'ezrat Hashem. So this is the, last week we began Parshat Kedoshim, and so this is continuing. There's lots of mitzvahs in this parsha. So these are the mitzvot of leaving food for the poor. So let's just look at the mitzvot that we have. Look at our sheet for a minute. So 216 is a positive mitzvah, to leave the edge of one's field, so to leave the peah, that's called the peah. And 217 is a negative mitzvah, not to reap every last end of one's field. So it's positive, negative. Same thing with 218 and 219, the precept of leaving the gleanings of the harvest for the poor, and 219, not to gather the stalks of grain that fell away during the harvest. 220, the mitzvah, the positive command of leaving part of the vineyard unreaped for the poor. And 221, the prohibition of reaping the entire vineyard. 222, positive, the precept of leaving fallen grapes in the vineyard for the poor. And 223, negative, the same thing, not to gather all the fallen grapes in the vineyard. So these eight mitzvot that we're going to see are positive, negative, right? So we have, so each one is reinforced.
Very symmetrical.
Yeah, so this is a very symmetrical, hopefully, class that we'll do today. So 216 really lays down the foundations of it, of those eight, because it's one unit, basically. So to leave over the unreaped part of the field of the produce, for it is stated, you shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. Right? So la'ani v'la'ger. Right? In Leviticus 19:10. So, and this comes after the text, that you shall not reap every last edge in your field. So now it goes into the meaning of ger, because we have a few different meanings for the word ger. It could just be stranger, and in this case it's saying that it's actually a righteous convert. So here it just defines it. Now the meaning of ger is a full righteous convert to Judaism, and so every occurrence of the term ger in regard to gifts to the poor. So every time when it's talking about gifts to the poor and uses the word ger, it means a righteous convert.
I thought we weren't supposed to refer to converts as ger.
Right. So some people say that ger is just when the person's in process, in between when they've made the decision and when they go to the mikvah, but it's not really the case. Mm-hmm. So, because you're not supposed to necessarily refer to them as that, and yet they still have a status of being familyless, like, or being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So they're still in the vulnerable category because they're familyless. So the poor, the convert, the widow, and the orphan are the vulnerable people, and the levi too. It's interesting. It's considered in the vulnerable category because they don't have land. So they're unlanded. So either unfamilied, unlanded, unhusband, you know, unparented, whatever it is. And I was just talking to a woman yesterday who's 50, but she was never married, ever. And she, her brother, only brother, her only sibling died last year, and her parents are both dead. And so she's alone in the world. She is an orphan, right? Even at 50, you think of just children as being orphans, but she is considered, you know, she needs to be cared for like an orphan because she's vulnerable. You know, nobody can help her out if she doesn't earn her money. There's nobody to give her extra. You know, she has to take care of her own security, and that's it. So that's what it's these categories. So here for the poor and for the ger. Although it's interesting, so the same definition holds true for all gifts of the poor. Nevertheless, the sages of blessed memory ruled that they are not to be withheld from poor non-Jews for the sake of peace. So, and for the sake of peace can be interpreted in two different ways. So I'll tell you both interpretations. You'll see the one that I'd like, of course. But, so for the sake of peace could be, so it's midarchei shalom. That's the, phrase that's used. Mipnei darchei shalom, for the ways of peace. That's the phraseology that's used in the text and is used regularly when it talks about things like this. So darchei shalom, for the non-Jew could be just so that we shouldn't get into trouble, right? You want to maintain peaceful relationships for our sake, for our shalom, so that we shouldn't look bad in their eyes, or we shouldn't be seen as nasty, or it's for our sake, for the sake of our peace, right? That's one way to read that. And the other way to read that is, the peaceful way in the world is to be kind and good and giving. And so for that way, even though, so that's its own separate category, it's not a positive commandment in and of itself, but it is considered a prerequisite for everything to work well. There has to be darchei shalom, there's ways, there's paths of peace upon which we should be traveling And so part of those paths of peace are to be reaching out to others, not just to be provincial and take care of only ourselves. So I, of course, go for explanation number two. But they're both there. So you'll see both of them. Both of those understandings are assumed in different texts. So you'll hear that.
Being shining light on the hill takes me to explanation number two.
Right, which is a little bit different, actually, because the shining light is about being an example, mm-hmm. leaders and examples. Mm-hmm. So really, the Star Chai Shalom would be a prerequisite to that.
Right.
Like, how can you be a leader and example right. without just basic good relations
right.
with those around you?
Right.
And then also, I think the first definition, though, is really apropos the sages having prophecy or vision of diaspora Jews living all over the world, scattered around, needing to compensate for, you know, their Cossack neighbor, in a sense, you know, or anywhere where they needed to be safe within
right.
the community.
Right. So Darchei Shalom is actually a pretty large principle and does include things like that, you know, let's say, like, you know, there might be a question, can you attend a block party? Or not, right? You live on a block with two Jewish families and 10 non-Jewish families, and they're making a block party in the summer. Should you go? Shouldn't you? Should you bring, you keep kosher, they don't. You know, obviously you're not going to eat their food, but should you bring something to contribute? Should you go? Shouldn't you go? You know, maybe you actually should. Midar Chai Shalom, that it's part of, you shouldn't look so separate that you should, that we are separate, that but that we should be contributing to the environment. Which there's all kinds of things like that, you know. Like, so it's a principle that you would want to figure out. How does that work? And so giving gifts to heads of state is certainly one of the things that we have traditionally done. It has been required of us at certain times, certainly by the Muslims. There's been that jizya tax, right, where you have to go give the head of state, whatever, the head of the Jews has to give the head of state a gift and be slapped in public.
Oh,
yeah.
What?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's if we do what?
That's if we live with Muslims. That's
if
all.
If we just...
That's all. That's it. That's it. That's all you got to do. That's just to keep you in your place.
Oh,
you
goodness.
Give your gift.
The
that's
dhimmi,
a Muslim
the
rule.
Status.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a dhimmi status.
Oh, dhimmi. Oh.
So the dhimmi status, but that's what's required. So jizya, I think it's jizya, is the tax that's paid. So the gift that's given to the head of state by the head of the Jews, who is then slapped in public, just to make it clear who's in charge of who. We're not, it's not like head of state
this
to head of
like
state.
If we start a community, like if Chabad would go back to
Iran.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know if it's if we started. We live there already, you know, like in Tunisia today. I don't know if it still is in effect today, but certainly was, I mean, until most of the Jews were kicked out of the Muslim countries in 1950.
Well, we lived there.
Yeah, so we lived there since the second. We lived there before the Muslims lived there. I mean, we lived there when the Arabs lived there, but they weren't Muslim yet.
Until 1,000, right.
Right, right. So 600, about 640, I think, is Muhammad. So
right.
Islam really spread very, very quickly. Yeah. Muhammad was, you know, it spread like in 20 years. It took over the entire thing. So from there, that's when they would have, Jews were already there. It's not like Jews moved into Muslim places. Jews were living with their Arab neighbors, and their
Muslim.
Arab neighbors became Muslim and had to make it clear, we're in charge. We are not peers, right? We run the show. You're subservient to us. Our theology requires that you be below us. And so this is how we will make it clear to us and to you that that's the case. You give us, we slap you, right? So,
just to keep.
Pardon? So I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think that most of the Jewish communities have left those
right.
kinds of places.
Right.
Not all of them.
If Chabad would go back.
Right.
Well, why would Chabad go if there's no Jewish?
Right. If there's no Jews,
right.
there's no
yeah.
Jews. Right.
right.
No. So there's a little right. bits and pieces left over. I mean, Libya is free of Jews now. Right. So you have Tunisia. You have a little bit left of Morocco. We have like
Iran,
six left
so.
In Iran, something,
yeah.
but it's not even a minion, literally not
yeah.
a minion. So
right.
I don't think that's done anymore. There's no head of the community. It's just the little leftovers that are, you know,
hanging
for whatever
for
reason. Yeah.
And we have the other Muslim communities like France. Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, there's a tons of
they
French Aliyah now because of that.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. We have the State of Israel now, so people can go.
Right.
People leave.
A place to go.
Right. Rather than put up with that, they leave.
Right. Right, and Germany has a problem, and England has a problem.
Norway.
The whole Europe has a problem.
Yeah, they do.
But France is the worst because they're French citizens.
Yeah, no.
Why are they leaving their countries is my question.
It's not a question at all.
It's kind of a rhetorical.
Want to live in France or Tunisia?
Right.
It's not a question at all.
Why are you focusing?
Yeah, yeah. It's not a question at all, but yeah, we'll talk about that another time. Okay, thank you. Okay, so... So now here's the substance of the mitzvah. That's the obligation of the unreaped part. Okay, so that's the payah. So we do read that every day, if we say Birkat HaTorah. So right, Elu Devarim She'ein Lehem Shiur HaPeah V'HaBikurim. Right, so HaPeah. These are the things that don't have a set amount. The payah. Right, so that's one of the things. So payah means corner here, and it's interesting that that's the same name, payos. Peyot is the same name as the side locks, the curls, where they don't shave the corner of their heads, whatever the corner of a round thing is. But it seems that we do somehow have a corner there that's not shaved. But so that's the peyot. So just to think about it, so the root of the precept altogether is to inculcate in us graciousness and thankfulness and a sense that it's not all ours. So that's what he says, at the root of the precept lies the reason that the Eternal Lord blesses. He wished that his people, whom he chose, should be adorned with every good and precious quality, and that they should have a blessed soul and a generous spirit. I have written previously that as a result of one's activities, the soul is influenced accordingly, and it thus becomes good, so that the blessing of the Eternal Lord is bestowed upon it. Well, there is no doubt that when a man leaves over part of the produce in his field and makes it ownerless so that those in need can benefit from it, you will perceive in his soul a fulfilling satisfaction and a decent and blessed spirit, whereupon the Eternal Lord will satisfy him with goodness, and his soul shall abide in good fortune. So, I think that's important to see. We saw this before. Does anybody remember which mitzvah we saw it before in? I'm testing you hard. Which mitzvah do we see the initial principle, and he states it a little bit differently, in that mitzvah, and the first time that we see it, it's Ha'adam Nif'al Kefi Pu'ulatav, Kefi Pu'ulato. The person operates according to his behavior. He is affected according to his behavior. So the first time we see that, and that is a principle of Sefer HaChinuch, is in mitzvah number 16, which is the mitzvah of not breaking the bone of the paschal sacrifice. Right, so in that mitzvah, he says to his son, "You may ask me, son, why do we have so many mitzvahs? Really, isn't it enough to say, offer the paschal sacrifice, it slaughter it according to its way, and at the right time, and burn the right parts, and eat the right parts? You also have to say, don't break the bone? Like, really, how many mitzvahs around one thing can there be? Well, son, if you'll ask me that, that would be foolish. Because I'll tell you the principle, and the principle is that a person is shaped according to his deeds. And so Hashem gave us a lot of mitzvahs so that we could be engaged in a lot of deeds that will cause us to be shaped in a positive way. That's basically what he's explaining. So that's what this is too. This is much easier to see, but he says it again here, and I think it's just important to look at the Hebrew because it's slightly different here. So it's on the top of page 14. The first four words there, mitoch ha-pe'ulot titpa'el ha-nefesh, according or from the actions, ha-pe'ulot titpa'el ha-nefesh, then the soul will be shaped, acted, however you want to translate that. So he translates it here, the soul is influenced accordingly. As the result of one's activities, the soul is influenced accordingly. So that is a principle that we've gone over again and again, and we certainly got from Derech Hashem, that the physical and the spiritual are not separate, and they're not different ends, disparate ends of a spectrum, but rather the physical is the means through which the spiritual is accomplished. Right? So here we have the physical, the gathering of the harvest. What a time of, it is a time of thankfulness, but it could be a time of pride in one's accomplishments. Right? Look what I did. I made this whole field full. And every farmer, I think, knows it's not all about him. But in the gathering, it is. You bought the field. You sowed the field. You did whatever you could do. And in the end, it's yours. It belongs to you. You made the investment. And Hashem is saying, no, it is yours, and it's not. You don't get the whole thing. You are responsible to be part of a nation and leave over certain parts of it. And so that has to be left over. Don't think that you get it all. Now, it's a message for the farmer, but let's say you have a big field. Is the farmer doing all the harvesting? Probably not. Maybe he is. Depends on the size of the farm.
Let's just, size of his family.
Size of his family, etc. Size of his wealth, right? But there certainly would be wealthy farmers who own the farm who are not working on it. So how does that wealthy person get that message? Right? So it's interesting just to think about the dynamics there. So that wealthy person has to cause his workers to behave in the correct way. He's responsible for it, as we'll see with the negative one, not to reap to the very last end of one's field. He's not permitted to tell them to reap the whole thing or to even just let them, right? He has to stop them and say, you have to stop here. But I think it's fascinating if you think about the message that it gives also to, let's say, the hired worker. Right, the entire time of the harvest, whether it's your field or whether you're hired, every time you reach your arm out to pick, you're thinking about the halacha. You have to. You can't do it without, because there's so much going on here. If we look ahead at our list, right, so there's his leaving the corner, that's peah, how much you should leave. And there is no minimum for that. There's no maximum and there's no minimum. There's a rabbinic minimum.
1/60.
There's a rabbinic minimum, which is 1/60. Right? But there's no maximum for that. So you have to leave something, right? You have to leave the corner, whatever that means. And it can't be in the middle, right? When we have in 2:17 not to reap to the very last end of one's field, it can't be that you leave the middle over. It has to be the edges. It has to be the edges because that is the convention. All the poor people know the edges belong to them. So they don't have to hunt for the place in your field where you left it for them. It's the edges, and they can count on that. So there's that. So that's peah. But then the gleanings, so anything that falls while you're picking, you're not allowed to stoop to pick up. Now, and there's a halachas about that, which we'll get to also. And then anything that wasn't ready to be picked, or that you left behind. It's interesting, it talks about knocking the olive tree, so we'll see that the olive trees are harvested that way where you hit them, right, and then the olives fall. And today, now we have good machines that do that. I think olives are largely still harvested by hand, but cherries are harvested by shaking machines. If you watch the cherry harvesters, if you watch any, YouTube's fabulous, if you watch any videos on YouTube, you could see how do you harvest cherries, right? They have a big machine that just goes and takes the whole trunk of the tree, spreads out a net around the whole thing, takes the trunk, shakes it hard, they all fall, and then it gathers it up, pours it into a chute, and drives to the next tree. It's amazing.
I wonder if they do that on the western slope. The cherries going up to the Grand Mesa. They used to always be picked by hand when I used to go over there. Uh-huh. But they may
I don't know.
Some machines.
I don't know. And they may do both. You know, they may do the bulk by machine, whatever falls easily, and then go over by hand.
So I wonder how does that change the halacha if it all falls?
It's not all going to fall.
Mm-hmm. And we'll see as we get to it, you're not permitted to spread a blanket on the ground to catch it all. If you think about it, so the harvester, whoever they are, whether the hired harvester or the owner of the field, has to be thinking the whole time they're harvesting. Every time they reach out, you know, they want to make sure that they don't drop it by mistake, right? And there's some rules about that too. Let's say they touched a thorn while they were holding it, and their hand opened because they were in pain. That doesn't count. You're allowed to bend down and pick that up, right? So there's halachas of what's by mistake, what's not. And if it's a lot, like let's say you have 3 sheaves in your hand and they drop, you're allowed to pick that up. But if it's 1 or 2, you're not. There's all kinds of halachas about it. But you do have to be thinking about it. You have to know those halachas, and you have to be thinking about it constantly because you're always evaluating. Was this dropping of that pile, you know, was it by mistake? Was it too much? Was it by pain? Can I pick it up? Can I not pick it up? Right? I'm sure that happens all the time. You know, all day long, you're dropping little bits and pieces. You have to know, can I pick it up or not pick it up? And then also in how much you harvest from it. Can I harvest all of that? Can I not harvest all? What's the story with it all? So you're constantly thinking about it. So even the hired worker is becoming expansive in thinking about leaving some over for the poor, even if it's not his. He knows, I can't harvest all of this. We Jews hold that it doesn't all belong to the owner of the field. It does belong to other people too, that we work and care for each other. So I think that's something that's woven into the very harvest is how much we care for each other, how much we're required to care for each other, and how much that physical activity of the expression of care affects our souls. That's the point of it, is that working through the physical, we transform our spiritual. Okay, so that is...
Just a question. Does this transpose this kind of sense into modern life today in terms of, say, for example, the term leaving money on the table or some sort of real estate deal? I mean, how is this translated into today's...
Right, so it's not fully translated into today. So it does say that... rabbinically, and I'm not aware that this is the case, but it says in here, on page 17, right, because he explains what the mitzvah is, and then what its root is, and then how to do it, and then to whom it applies and when, right, that's the order of every one of the mitzvahs in Sefer Chinuch, to whom it applies and when, and then what's the punishment if you transgress, right? That's the order of every single one. So here we have to whom it applies, right? So end of 17, by the law of the Torah, it applies to both man and woman, to an ordinary Israelite, a Kohen, and a Levite, but specifically in the land of Israel and at the time the Israelites are there, which doesn't mean the time the temple is there. Sometimes some mitzvot are only for when the temple is there. But this is for at the time the Israelites are there, so right now, right? As the law for truma, so the same thing with truma, and the part of the produce given to the Kohen, and masrot, tithes. So, according to the Rambam of blessed memory, who stated that trumot and masrot are enforced to be observed only in the land, and at the time that the Israelites are there, as we will write, with the Eternal Lord's help, in the sixth positive precept, okay, 507, when we get there to Shoftim. By the ruling of the sages, however, it is in effect even outside the land. And he of blessed memory wrote, that's the Rambam, that it seems to him that the same law holds for the other gifts to the poor, that they are in force to be observed outside the land by the ruling of the sages. So I'm not clear if that is in force today.
Could this be the rabbis?
I know, that is the rabbis. That's the rabbis.
Bonuses? Or could this be construed as tzedakah? I mean,
well, no, so first of all, this is literally when you own a field.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what we didn't look at inside here is where does it apply? This is important. Let's say you have your own garden, right? You have a garden in the back of your house. What are you supposed to do? Okay, so in general, it doesn't apply to that because that's green produce. So let's look at the end of page 15. Okay. Further, our sages of blessed memory gave this rule for the duty of leaving an unraped part of the field, right? Whether it's a bit of field or a produce or a part of the orchard. Okay, so whatever it is, it has to be a bit of a field or field of produce or a part of an orchard, those two things. So that turns out to be number one because there's five conditions here. So it has to be a bit of a field or part of a produce, part of an orchard. That's one. All food that is grown from the earth, two, watched or tended, three, gathered all at once, four, and taken somewhere to keep it, right? For instance, grains, legumes, carob, nuts, almonds, grapes, olives, dates, and everything similar that has these five characteristics is subject to the obligation of leaving an unreaped part, right? But not green vegetables. So in your garden, you go out and pick lettuce for your salad that day. You're not harvesting all at once. You're not saving it. You are tending it. It is part of your field. And you are tending it. So that's two of the conditions. But a third condition of harvesting the whole thing all at once and gathering it to a place to save does not exist. Right? So let's say it was a field of pumpkins. It probably would count. Because pumpkins you do harvest all at once. You don't take them one by one. It's not like where you pick a pepper when that pepper's ready, right? You do the whole field of pumpkins all at once, or the whole field of potatoes all at once, and you can gather them and save them, right, for the winter. So in that case, that field would come under it. But a field of alfalfa, even though you're going to harvest the whole thing at once, you're not gathering it and saving it. It has to be eaten right away. Maybe you dry it. I don't know how it works for cows or whatever they do. But for human food, right? So Right. For things that you're harvesting that you have to send out, or, you know, like if you are a tomato farmer, so you're not gathering it and saving it. You're gathering it, you are harvesting it, and then out it goes. It can't be saved. So it has to have those conditions. Okay. Those fields are the ones that...
Potatoes would be exempt because those can be saved for long periods of time in cold storage.
Right, so right. I think so. So I'm not saying for sure, right?
Yeah.
But that's where, those are the principles of it.
Okay.
So the first level of Marlon's question is, how does this apply today? So the first answer is, this is about agriculture, that it applies to that. And I'm not sure if we apply it to our fields today. Does a Jewish farmer somewhere in Colorado who has, I don't know, apple trees, you know, so does this apply to him or not? Does he have to leave it or not? I'm not sure. And it may make a difference.
It sounds like the sages aren't sure, because the Rambam says, only in the land.
Right, for sure it applies in the land. So today in the land it applies. The question is, does it apply in Colorado? Right? So, and it might make a difference, not just that it's chutz la'aretz, but also that we are a welfare state. You know, that we don't have poor that are wandering the countryside looking for food at this stage in our nation's existence. It's not a thing. Now, there are certain laws. Let's say you hire, you know, whatever farm workers to harvest your field, you're not allowed to tell them not to eat. That's a Torah law. They're allowed to eat on the job. They can eat whatever they, like if they're harvesting cherries, they can put one in the bag and one in their mouth. They're allowed to do that till their tummies are full. They're permitted. They can't take them home, but they're allowed to eat on the job. That is a Torah law. So, and that applies today.
So we don't know if the principle, what I heard Marlon saying was that since we are no longer an agrarian society per se, then does the fruits of our labor, which would be our paycheck or whatever, would that?
So
would
we
would you take the same principle and apply it to that?
So I think so. I don't think we take this principle to apply to that.
Okay.
We are not leaving corners of our paycheck, and we're not leaving behind gleanings. You know, this is specifically referring to that. However, we clearly have a principle
of tzedakah.
So tithing. So I think the 10%, the trumot and masrot, where we take 10% of our produce after we've left our peah, and after we've left our shechacha, and after we've left the leket, which we'll get to. Then, after we've gathered what's permitted to us to gather, we take 10% of that off to give to the Kohanim and Levi'im. So that, I think we do still do today in our tithing our money, you know, taking 10% of our money. So, because that can be more easily translated into today. I'm not sure if there's another basis for tithing our produce, which that leads into tithing our money. But it does seem to be very closely like that you would be learning that from that. So, but do we learn something out from this? So I think I'm not aware of something that we do directly today that comes from the peah and the leket and the shechacha, except for the principles. So not that we have to do, but the principles of it's not all ours. We have responsibility to others, and we are supposed to share. It is interesting, though. He says in here also. Let's see if I could just. Where it says here on page 15, just before where we read, let's see, there's that paragraph that starts further, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines up in the middle is another word, further. Further, there's what the sages of blessed memory said, that if there are no poor to take the produce of the leftover part, the owner of the field is permitted to take it, for it is stated for the poor. It is stated for the poor and for the stranger, and our sages of blessed memory interpreted, but not for the ravens and the bats. So you're not just leaving it to leave it, right? You don't have to leave it for wild animals to come eat it or
there's
for it to rot. If there's
and
nobody to gather
it,
you're allowed to take it. But if there
but
is
it's
somebody
for the poor.
It's for the poor, so if there's nobody to gather it, right. So, but you're allowed to in this case. If you're, you know, wherever, in the middle of nowhere and there's nobody there, or if you're living in Israel and, I don't know, let's say in the early state days, right, or before the state, in the early, what's that called? During the first and second Aliyah. Yeah, during Palestinian time, early 1900s, you were a farmer in the Galilee, right? And there's nobody around you because you're one of the pioneers.
Right.
So, and they're not, the poor from Yerushalayim aren't coming up, right? So you don't have to leave that. You still have to tithe and send somewhere. And still in the Shemitah year, you would gather it and then send it, you know, hefker to whoever wants to eat it. You would still do that. But you don't have to leave the edges where nobody's going to come and harvest it just because you're supposed to leave the edges. You're in the land of Israel, and there are Jews there, but they're not close by. They're not coming to get it. You don't just leave it.
Well, I thought that they were leading me to the thought that I could gather it, but when I gathered it, I needed to give that away.
But unless there's no poor to give it to.
Okay. There's always poor.
Yeah.
Yeah, but okay, so
and
let's just take.
To transport it someplace.
Right, so let's just take. Do you have to do that? I don't think so. I don't think that's what the halacha is saying. I don't think you have to put it in your wagon and drive it to go looking for a poor person.
Okay.
However, if you do live in a place, right now let's move back to where there's people all around and there are poor people and you harvested your whole field, right, against, you weren't supposed to do that, but you did it. You can do tshuva by giving what would have been the quantity of those corners to poor people.
Is it all corners?
Yeah.
Or just one corner?
No, all four corners.
All four corners.
Mm-hmm. I think about that when I'm flying, and I fly back into Colorado, mm-hmm. and we have the circle irrigation.
Right. Oh, right, yeah. Right.
I'm like, hey, there's no corners at all on that field. They cut it right off because we have that high-efficiency irrigation where there's no corners.
First came from Israel.
Right, it did come from Israel. It's true. So I just wonder, you know, where's the halacha on that? You know, so if you have, if you're using that circle irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting thing, too. There is a tzedakah in Israel called Leket Israel, because not everything is harvested. And so they have volunteers who go out into the fields and collect the leket and give it to the poor. And you guys may have gotten a Rosh Hashanah card from me from them, because I did give a donation to them and then send out Rosh Hashanah cards.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what they do. They go out, and it's actually run by Joseph Gittler, who is the brother of Aaron Denver, Rabbi Gittler. He founded it.
Oh, Mark's brother.
Yeah, he founded it, and he runs it, like at Israel, where they gather the leftover produce from the fields. Yeah, yeah. And that's considered a very good tzedakah. I mean, a very... They use their money very well, very efficiently, and get a lot of money, a lot of food to the poor for a little money. They have a big volunteer force that goes and gathers produce. But they still need, so where does the money come in? The money comes in from renting trucks and sacks and stuff like that. You have to gather it and put
fuel,
it somewhere.
Right.
Fuel, like they don't own all, they don't, they're not, right, yeah, right. That, so that does cost. Right, so is the farmer required to spend the money to deliver to the poor? I don't think so. So that would be right. But he is required to leave it. So if it can be gathered. Now, if somebody's not gathering it, I think a farmer could gather it. But look, if it's there and there's people who will gather it, so then he has to leave it. So
I'm sure there are questions like if you leave it for 3 days, nobody's come to get it.
Right. So it probably does make a difference.
Or there's, you know, some time limit because it'll go bad if you don't get it into the silo.
Right. So all of that stuff would be in tractate Peah. The rest of the many details are in the Mishnah tractate composed about this, and that's called tractate Peah. And that would have all the details of all that kind of stuff, because you're right, there's all those kinds of questions. You are not required to let your food spoil on the floor waiting for the poor to come. So when can you go back? You have workers anyway, so when can you go back and re-glean? That would all be in Peah and Makot, apparently, are the two places. Okay, 217, that's much shorter. So those are the basic principles of it, right? 217, not to reap the entire crop, but rather to leave a remnant of it over for the poor at the edge of the field. As it is stated, you shall not wholly reap your field to its very end. So this negative precept's transgression is given over to a positive precept for rectification. For it is stated, you shall leave them for the poor and for the strangers. So if you didn't, then you have this one. In other words, if the person transgressed and reaped the entire field, he is to give to the poor out of the produce the amount of an unreaped part, which is 1/60th by the ruling of the sages who so obligated us. But the law of the Torah has no fixed amount, as we learned in the Mishnah. These are the things for which there is no fixed amount, the unreaped part, the Peah. And the root reason for the precept that we just discussed in 2:16. Okay, 2:18. So this is the mitzvah of leket, mitzvat leket. So it's interesting. You have here in the Hebrew just two words, mitzvat leket, and in the English, this whole long translation, the precept of leaving the gleanings of the harvest for the poor. Because if you know what leket is, that's the whole thing. But it's, you can't translate that one word so easily. So to leave the gleanings for the poor. These beings, so what are the gleanings? What is the definition of leket? That which falls from the sickle during the reaping or from the hand during the picking. For it is stated in regard to gleanings, you shall leave them to the poor and to the stranger. So it's the same thing. So we just have three different ways of leaving food for them, right? So there's the edges and then there's the leket. So that which falls. So I don't know exactly what it looks like when somebody harvests with a sickle. I mean, I've seen movies and stuff, but to see up close. So what is falling? What is being gathered and what is falling? How does that work? You think you grab and swipe at the same time?
And then whatever falls down.
I'm just thinking, I mean, you usually swing the sickle with two hands, right? That's how I've seen it. So, but do you, maybe do you swing and then quickly grab before it hits? I don't know.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so it seems that somehow something could fall, and if it does, you can't pick it up, unless it's a lot, in which case you can, because you didn't mean for that to fall. But what falls just regularly, you have to leave. And here's where it says, if two... one or two ears of grain are gleaning. It's interesting why they call it ears of grain. Ears of corn, I get, but ears of grain. Which in Hebrew is shibolet. Shibolet. So whatever that means. But we use that word in English, ears of grain. So if three ears or more fall together from the reaper's hand, all three belong to the owner. But if one or two, then they belong to the poor. For the law of gleaning applies only to a smaller amount. This then holds specifically when the gleanings fell from the reaper's hand where there was no compulsion. But if a thorn struck his hand and they fell, they are not gleanings for the poor. Where there is doubt, if certain ears, etc., are gleanings, they are considered to be gleanings. So we rule strictly on the gleanings. For it is stated, grant the afflicted and the destitute right. Grant him the right to what is yours and give it to him, is what it means. Then there's the law of grain found in ant holes. Whatever that might mean. You know, does that count? Does that not count? It seems amazing to me that people could be that picky that they would wonder about the, you know, I mean, we're so wealthy today, it's so hard for us to imagine.
It is.
You know, how...
But look at Africa today. If a piece of grain fell in an animal, right. You'd go after it.
So I'm saying it's so hard for us to imagine. Because I'm busy looking at a pastry that's a day old thinking, you know, it's a day old. I don't know if I want to eat that. You know, right, but I'm just saying, like, that's how picky I could be, you know, that I'd rather not eat bread that's not fresh or a pastry that's a day old, you know, I'd rather have it be fresh, you know, and I'm not thinking about, like, you know, starving and eating anything, being grateful for even moldy bread, you know, and they're looking at grains in ant holes, so that is a totally different era of abundance. Mm-hmm. Or lack thereof. Okay, so the law of grain found in ant holes and the law of an ear from gleanings that became mixed up in a stack. So what happens? You know for sure that is, I don't know, you have your stack that you're gleaning, it's on the wagon, right? Your stack, not that you're gleaning, you have your stack of your harvest, it's on the wagon.
And something falls off.
Oh, something falls off, that's one thing.
Right.
Let's say it falls off, or let's say somebody less educated comes up behind you and makes a whole scoop of stuff you chose to leave behind because you knew that that's leket. Somebody grabs it and tosses it on the wagon. Uh-oh. Mm. Now what's the leket and what's the permitted harvest? Mm. Right? What do you do? So that's a question. And I'm sure that happens. So that's also discussed. It's not giving the answer here. But it's saying the law of an ear from gleanings that became mixed up in a stack. That's going to be found later. The rest of its details are explained in Mishnah Tractate Peah. And regarding the location where it's in effect, who bears the obligation to observe it, and the punishment of a person who transgresses it, all is the same for the leftover unreaped part of the field, that which we discussed earlier, right? So that it does apply in the land to men and women, to Kohen, Yisrael, Levi, whoever owns a piece of land, it applies to them when the Jews are in the land. And so that's biblically and rabbinically outside the land too. Okay, 2:19, not to gather stalks of grain that fell away during the harvest. So that's the negative of this positive that we just read, right? So the positive is leave them, and the negative is don't go gathering them. Same thing. 2:20, the precept of leaving a part of a vineyard unreaped for the poor. So you might just think that it's a field, right? An orchard or a field. But here, a vineyard is different. It's not trees, and it's not... and it's not grain, it's kind of in between product. You know, what is the law of a vineyard? So specifically, the vineyard is also included because it's not in the other categories, but you also have to leave a paya in the vineyard. Now here's where it gets a little confusing. Right, so here it says, to leave over an unharvested part of the vineyard. Scripture used the term olalot to denote this unharvested part. So it's saying that's not peya. In a vineyard, it's called olalot, according to opinion one, as we'll see, which is to say that we are commanded to leave all of the olalot in the vineyard as the unharvested part. And this is why it is written, you shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. After scripture mentions, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare. Okay, so you might think that's the peah. This is the view of the Rambam of blessed memory about the small single bunches of grapes in the vineyard, that they are in place of the unharvested part of other trees. So if there's unharvested parts of olive trees, you're not supposed to harvest them. So now he's saying olalot is not the peah, but rather olalot refers to, let's say, little bunches of grapes or things that you didn't harvest.
On purpose,
left over.
Too small.
Right. However, Ramban of blessed memory did not explain it so. In the negative precept, you shall not strip your vineyard bare, which is in this sedra, I will write the main point of their difference of opinion at length. So we have now a machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban. I will also explain there how we learn that an unharvested part of all trees should be left, and so likewise the whole subject matter for the precept, as is my custom, with the eternal Lord's help. Okay, so you can see he writes this in chunks. It's so interesting to, like, you know, see it. There's like little journal entries sort of in there.
To-do list.
Right.
I think I've heard that you can't go back if you're harvesting.
Right. Right.
That you can't go and say, well, we missed.
Right. That's the shechacha.
Oh, that's
right.
Not
leket is what you drop.
Right.
Shechacha is what you forgot.
Okay.
Now, but there is a question of that which wasn't ripe yet. Mm. Can you go back and reharvest that? So, and that, I'm not sure. I think it applies differently in different produce, in different fields, if you're allowed to go back and get that. Because if it's all ripe and just those things aren't, so maybe that is supposed to, maybe that's Hashem's way of holding it back for the poor and saying, okay, in a week, this is going to be ready. It's not worth it for you to go through the field again, but the poor person sure can. It's going to be ripe in a week for them, but you're not harvesting it for your wines. You know, it's for them. So that depends. But let's look here. So this is an interesting thing. Do we have enough time to go into it? We'll see. Okay. The prohibition of reaping absolutely all the fruit of a vineyard. So you're not allowed to remove absolutely all the fruit of a vineyard during the vintage harvest. It's not a word I'm familiar with to use it that way. But rather to leave over an unharvested part of them for the poor. As it is stated, you shall not strip your vineyard bare. And this is peah, the leftover unharvested part of the vineyard. So Ramban of blessed memory wrote. So he's saying this equals peah, the Ramban. But we know that this book is going basically according to who? Testing it. Correct. In general, he goes by the Rambam, right? So he's first bringing the Ramban's opinion. Yeah, but he goes by Rambam. He said further that you shall not go over the boughs behind you about
That's
olive trees. You can't signifies unharvested leftover part of an olive orchard, for the unharvested part of the olive orchard is called porat, and the unharvested part of the vineyard olalot. And from these two, we learn that the law applies to all trees. So since we have the halacha written about olive trees, and we have the halacha written about a vineyard, so from that we derive that it applies to all trees. So even oranges and apples and et cetera, you wouldn't be able to go back and reharvest. However, Ramban of blessed memory refuted him about this. So that's what the Rambam said. Wait.
No, it says Ramban.
Ramban refuted him. So we got to Rambam.
Not yet.
Yeah, it says Ramban of blessed memory wrote.
Right.
And now we say Ramban of blessed memory refuted him about this. Maybe that's a typo.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I read in the notes there's this whole long fight. I know, right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know which is which.
Ramban of blessed memory, so that must be Ramban first. Because here Ramban of blessed memory refuted him about this and said it is entirely erroneous. He holds that the negative precept, you shall not strip your vineyard bare, applies specifically to a vineyard, meaning you cannot derive apples and oranges from vineyards and olives. It means we should leave over all the small grapes that have neither shoulder nor dripping. That's katef and nataf. So katef, the meaning of shoulder, is sprigs, one over the other, and dripping denotes all that hang and go down. Hence, according to this, olalot are the small grapes found in vineyards at times, which are called in Spanish gatimas in the foreign tongue, right? And this is certainly something quite little, as it appears in our vineyards. So too did our sages say, what is defined as olalot, whatever is neither shoulder nor dripping. Now, so here's the machloket. So Rambam is saying that olalot is peah, basically, or forgotten things. On all trees, right? Mm-hmm. Well, olalot refers specifically to grapes, but that the concept is you can't go back and reharvest, mm-hmm. and that olalot in grapes is peah. Whereas the Ramban says, no, olalot, first of all, you can't learn about all trees. And second of all, olalot refers not to peah, not to the corners, but it refers specifically to the shoulder or dripping parts of the grapes, meaning that they have a certain look. Each cluster, they're small and they don't hang over, mm-hmm. certain type of a look of cluster that you can't hold. Now, what it says in the commentary here, which you could read at length, we don't have time to read the whole thing right now, but you'll see it's a very long note number two. It goes for a few pages. See that? Mm-hmm. It's several pages. It's almost a page long of a note divided over a few pages. So what it says in that note is that basically the Rambam made a mistake.
Maimonides.
All trees.
Maimonides made a mistake in terms of understanding this precept, and that mistake is not found in some of his later works. But it is found in Sefer HaMitzvot. So in Sefer HaMitzvot, which he's basing this book on, right, is following what the Rambam teaches in Sefer HaMitzvot, because the Rambam has his Sefer HaMitzvot where he goes through his count of 613, but he does positives and then negatives, as opposed to this is arranged by Parsha. So the Sefer Chinuch is basically following the Rambam's rulings in his Sefer HaMitzvot. However, the Rambam also wrote the Mishneh Torah, which is his encyclopedic compilation of everything that's in the Talmud and all halacha. So by the time he writes the Mishneh Torah, and then after he wrote his major works, he went back and revised everything to make sure it was all correct. So apparently in the Mishneh Torah, this mistake is not repeated. But it's a mistake based on some agricultural piece of misinformation that he had. So apparently they compared some earlier documents and they find it in some earlier documents and that's in some later ones of the Mishneh Torah, of the Sefer HaMitzvot, but that this book was based on this machloket, what he's writing here is based on the part of the Rambam that was in error, where the Maimonides actually made a mistake. And that later on that mistake was corrected, but he wasn't able to correct all of his works, or certainly not every single copy of all of his works, because some are written and out there already. So that's a fascinating thing, just to see that little piece of history there, that there is a mistake.
Go over the mistake again.
So the mistake is, what does olalot mean?
Okay.
Right, so does it mean peah? And I'm not exactly sure, you know, so he's saying, let's see. The mistake is a mistake in how it works. Let's see, where is it? See.
In the first paragraph where it says the law applies to all trees.
So it's not a mistake I think it is also a mistake in the law, but it's based on a mistake in understanding how it worked. Where did it go?
What shoulder and drippings are, or how to define.
Let's see if we can find this. Rambam continues. Let's see, say from this book.
It says on in the root, what is defined as olalot, whatever has neither shoulder nor dripping.
Right, so it's a question, but is that, that's according to the Ramban.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, but according to the Ramban, it doesn't have to do with that at all.
Yeah.
Right, according to the Ramban, so that is a typo there. In the first paragraph where it says Ramban, and blessed remember, it says Ramban there. Right, so not to saying, this is peah, it's equating olalot with peah. And the Ramban is saying, no, it's not the same thing, it's something else. So I think that's the main machloket, because here you see on the bottom of page 23, it says there are four gifts for the poor in the vineyard. Gleanings, that's leket, olalot, forgotten bunches, that's shechacha, and the unreaped part, that's peah. So I'm reading on the bottom of page 23. So we've been discussing the three gifts to the poor. The three classic gifts are leket, shechacha, and peah, right? The corners, the dropped pieces, and the forgotten harvest, right? Those three things. Here it's adding in a fourth, so it seems like the Rambam would say there's still only three, that olalot is just the word that's used for peah in vineyards. Whereas the Ramban is saying, in fact, there's four gifts in vineyards that you add on a fourth one, and that's olalot. Right? That's a machloket. So, yeah. Well, so it is interesting, all the picky stuff, because it makes a difference. You know, I mean, think about my glasses, right? So picky. Oh, it was just an eighth of an inch off. Well, it means I can't see, right? It has to be reground because, yes, a little bit makes a difference.
A foot on a bridge.
Right.
An inch short.
Right. It makes a difference. So on the one hand, you know, it's very common for people to feel like, Judaism's not real anyway. The laws don't matter anyway. So then it is like so picky, like you wrote this. But the truth is, if you understand that it's the truth, that there's a spiritual reality and that the way we operate physically triggers spiritual things to happen, which then goes back into the physical, it goes back and forth. It's a symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. How we behave physically affects our spirituality. How we're driven spiritually affects our physicality. How our spirituality is refined through our physical behavior goes back into informing our physical, goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So if you understand the relationship, then you understand that a little bit makes a difference. There is no saying, it's just a little thing, who really cares? It does really care. It does really matter. Okay, 222. This is basically the leket for grapes. Right, the precept of leaving fallen grapes in a vineyard for the poor, except for here, leket in grapes is called peret. Right, to leave over the peret of the vineyard for the poor, this being what separates and falls from the grapes during the vintage harvest. So this might not be the bunches. This might be grapes that fall off the bunches. You're not supposed to bend down and pick them up. Right, it may be little bunches too. But if you think about it, when you pick up a bunch of grapes, so the grapes fall. That you're not supposed to bend down and pick those up. For it is written, you shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. After scripture has stated, neither shall you gather the peret of your vineyard. In the negative precept, neither shall you gather. I will write everything concerning this mitzvah with the eternal Lord's help. So that's this next one. The prohibition of gathering the fallen grapes in a vineyard. So 223, not to gather fallen grapes in a vineyard, but we should rather leave them for the poor. For it is written, neither shall you gather peret, the fallen fruit of your vineyard, which means the single grapes that fall off during the picking of the bunches. The same law applies to other trees that are similar to grapevines. We are duty-bound not to gather the single fruits that fall loose. I wonder if that's like...
So that could be the cherries or maybe the apples or the oranges if you shake them and some stay...
Well, if you're doing it by shaking, yes, if you're doing it by shaking. Mm-hmm. But what about, let's say, dates? Dates also come in clumps. You pick a whole thing of dates. You don't pick them one by one.
Bananas,
right? So if one bananas one would be pretty hard for a banana to fall off. I don't think they had bananas in Israel at the time. Right, they're a New World fruit.
But
the certainly dates come in clusters. They look sort of grapey like that. Come in those big clusters. So anything that's like that, you're not allowed to. That drops one drops off. You have to leave it. And the reason is just what they wrote in Peah and. And here, what is peret? The definition is one or two grapes that separate from the bunch during the harvest. But if three grapes fall at once, they're not peret. If a person goes picking the grapes and dropping them to the ground, then when he removes the bunches, if a half a bunch is found there, it is peret too. So like, let's say he climbs up or he's just like, he clips and lets them all fall to the ground. And then he goes to pick them up. He's allowed to do it that way. But if he goes to pick up a cluster
and one falls,
not just one, but now a little piece of the whole cluster leaves, like a little mini cluster is the hint that you have to leave. It's saying here, right? You're allowed to do that, but whatever. Once you pick up the cluster and something's left behind, that's considered what's left behind, and you have to leave that. If you put a basket under a vine when he picks the grapes, he's robbing the poor.
Oh.
Not allowed to do that.
Everything. Right,
the rest of its details are in the tractate Peah as to the subject of the location in which this precept is in effect and for whom it is written above in the second positive precept. I'll tell you one place where this applies today. It doesn't apply, but where we behave on this, right? So it just occurred to me, think about how much extra work it is. It's so much easier to go and put the basket underneath and clip right into the basket, right? That's much easier and more efficient, right? But instead, we're making our agricultural workers, hired or selves, sit there with our hands, clip, put in the basket, clip, put in the basket. You can't just be efficient about it and do it. Mm-hmm. So where is a place where we do that? In surgical strikes in the military. So much easier and cheaper to just drop a big bomb to get the bad guy and his neighbors, right? But we don't do that. Instead, we have laser-directed, you know, multi-hundred thousand dollar bombs to get the one guy because we don't want to cause the collateral damage, right? So we're willing to take the extra time, the extra risk, the extra money to do it right, to do it carefully. So this is taking the extra time and the extra effort. It's a lot of extra work to not just stick a basket or drop a blanket underneath a tree, mm-hmm. shake the tree, and then pick up the blanket. That's so much easier than having to actually go and clip each one and put it in, you know. But we take the time. If we understand that's not wasting time, that's a principle that you can derive. It is not wasting time to do things right. It's using time correctly. Because how we behave physically affects us spiritually. So if you see the goal as harvesting grapes, then you're making a mistake. The goal is to affect your soul. You need to eat grapes. You need a parnassa. You need to leave things over. Harvesting grapes is a way to affect your soul. It's a way to keep the world running. It's a way to keep you fed. But the goal isn't the grapes. The goal is your soul, always. And that's what we have to see in all our business practices too. Right? The goal is keeping the world running in a Torah way, transforming our souls. The goal is figuring out to constantly see the world as an opportunity for soul transformation and growth. And when we think that the goal is just to find that parking space and not to give it to somebody else, right? Just to park your car, but not to drive politely, right? So then you've missed the point. The goal is how do I transform my soul through this? And that's what this is teaching. So that's where it applies.
Beautiful.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.